Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
At 70 years old, Kim Gordon, the former bassist and founding member of Sonic Youth, is somehow making the most abrasive music of her career right now. This month, she dropped her second solo album called The Collective with producer Justin Raisin, who's previously worked with artists like Drake, Lil Yachty, and Charlie XCX. Kim's spoken word-like vocals on The Collective are the perfect accompaniment to Justin's distorted trap-style beats, especially on her first single, Bye Bye, which was originally intended for rapper Playboi Carti. On today's episode, Leah Rose talks to Kim Gordon about her latest solo album, as well as her memoir, Girl in a Band, that detailed her very public split with ex-husband Thurston Moore. Kim also delves into why she always felt like an outsider in New York City's thriving downtown art scene and recalls Sonic Youth's storied tour in the early 90s opening up for Neil Young. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Leah Rose's conversation with Kim Gordon.
I saw that you're getting ready to play some shows to support the new album. How are you going to translate the album or the songs or the new music to the stage? What are you guys thinking?
Well, it's just so it'll be the same group of girls that I toured the last record with. But the drummer will have probably have some kind of hybrid kit. So she'll be... I don't know what she'll be doing. She'll be playing some of the beats live and then sampling stuff, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Same with the guitar player and the bass player. They're all very technologically savvy. I'm kind of the only one who isn't. Yeah, and there'll be some things on backing tracks that we just can't reproduce.
And for the recording of the songs, were you playing with a live band or was it mostly...
No.
Okay. It's mostly programmed stuff.
Yeah, it was basically me and Justin Raisin. He was my collaborator. Like I said, I wanted to have more beats on this record and he would basically send me beats. I talked about what sort of, hip hop I liked, and I'm sort of inspired by rhythm because I'm not a very melodic singer. My range is kind of limited, let's just say. Anyway, so he would make up beats with some sounds and send it to me, and I would decide what I thought I could work on. And then I would go in and make up guitar parts in the studio and lay down some vocals and usually start out with some of the songs I had complete lyrics, but I still didn't know how I was going to place them, you know. And then other songs I would have, you know, half lyrics, and then I would sort of start improvising, or other things would come out of my mouth. And I go, where'd that come from?
Yeah.
And so then it became like for him, like sort of a shaping, editing kind of process. And then, you know, sometimes he would sample my guitars and put it back in. And then I would go back and then usually add more guitar or vocals.
So the guitar is you playing?
Yeah, although there might be some things he played guitar on, but mostly it's me. And then I had Sarah come in the end and add more dense noise stuff.
What were the reference, the hip hop reference tracks that you gave him?
You know, like Schoolie D, Gucci Time. Or...
Oh, old school.
Yeah, yeah. Mostly like, yeah, 80s or 90s. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't really give him that many references, but... And then for the last record, we talked about, you know, I'd played him different things, like even ESG, or there was this single I really liked by this band, The Jellies, just like a super minimal kind of fun song from like 82 or 83.
That's cool. I thought some of the music sounds like kind of like blown out dub and trap beats. So I thought maybe you were referencing more recent stuff.
Well, yeah, there is some, reference to recent stuff. But it's kind of like, well, I liked, on the last record, I really liked that song, Paprika Pony, which is a trap beat. So I was like, I know that he makes beats for other people. And so I knew that, yeah, that would involve other things. But it wasn't like I specifically pointed out some, you know, contemporary person.
Yeah, I've been reading some of the things that are being written about what's been released so far, and people are like, you know, like you're dropping bangers, like trap bangers, and it's so great.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Justin gets a kick out of that. Like, he couldn't wait for like his hip hop world or whatever to hear the record or something.
How did you two meet? How did you start working together?
Super accidentally. Actually, I met him through his brother, Jeremiah, who I think curates beats for Drake or something. People send him beats. It was actually just in a restaurant, and I was with a friend, and he was with this girl, and our tables were so close together, and they had kind of a friend vibe, but then suddenly they started talking about their sex life together, and our tables were so close that we just all turned to look at each other and started laughing. So we just started talking, and he was kind of like, yeah, my brother's a producer, and he did the Skyrocket record. And that was kind of a cool record. But when usually people say the word producer, my head kind of just turns off. Like, I don't know, it's not the way I've ever worked. So, but then, yeah, Justin started DMing me, and he was working on a project with Lawrence Rothman, and they were having different people come in and do vocals along with Lawrence. And I wasn't actually living in LA then. I was staying in an Airbnb. And yeah, I thought he was sort of a character, but he kept sending me stuff. But eventually he sent me something that, okay, I could do something on this. And so I went over, and he has this home studio in his garage. It's a very big garage, LA style. And I did some vocals, and he basically took what was left over and put a very trashy drum track to it and sent it to me. And I was really surprised. I was just like, oh, he really knows my sensibility. And so I went back and he had Stella from Warpaint come in and put drums over it. And I put some guitar on it and vocals, and that became Murdered Out. And then it wasn't until like 6 months later that I think we actually started working on a record.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, it was kind of, I really didn't have any desire to do a solo record. You know, I play with Bill Nace. We have a experimental guitar duo improv group and Bodyhead. And so, and I have, you know, I make visual art. So I wasn't really thinking about launching a solo career in that sense.
Does Bill like this solo stuff that you're doing?
He's very supportive. You know, he says he does, but I don't know what he really thinks.
The thing that struck me about it is a lot of the people that we talk to, as people get older, things start to get quieter, their music starts to slow down. And this is the opposite of that. It's so noisy in the best way. Is that something that you were intending to do from the beginning? Was that part of the original concept?
No, I didn't really think about it, actually. Not at all. I don't know. Like, it wasn't really till it was done that I thought, oh God, it's really a loud record. I mean, I'm kind of a slow developer, so I'm just now making a really loud record.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I kind of see the record as an intervention into the culture.
Tell me more. What does that mean?
Like, because it's so different and so kind of abrasive in some way and not an easy listening kind of record, it has this other thing about it. And I think people seem to be more and more ready for things that aren't conventional. And I don't know. So I think it's just meant to be a bit, little bit of a disruption into what is business as usual.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I didn't really, like, I didn't, you know, this is all, like, I'm saying this, but it's kind of unconsciously done.
Do you listen to loud music normally?
Not normally, actually. You know, if I'm just around my house, no. Like, I'll listen to, like, even John Fahey, you know, or, like, Brazilian music or Bardo Pond, you know, kind of. Actually, I love Bardo Pond. Like, I love that there's something really glorious and beautiful about their drone. It's very soothing to me, even though it's kind of loud.
I don't know if this is a connection between earlier music you've made with Sonic Youth, but seems like you're sort of comfortable with the drone.
Yeah.
Do you see any sort of connective tissue between the music you were making with Sonic Youth and the new solo music?
I mean, you know, in some ways, like, the songs that I sang on were the ones that were kind of more abstract slabs of music and, you know, songs that we'd kind of make up all together sitting around, as opposed to ones often Thurston would come in with a melody and he would know what he wanted to sing. And then we'd find our parts to it and still arrange it all together. But other songs, it was kind of a challenge, like, what, how am I going to sing on this? And in a way, like, being presented with, like, beats and pieces of music with sound and beats, it wasn't dissimilar. You know, it was kind of, okay, what can I do with this? And, you know, if I didn't feel like I could do something, obviously I wouldn't do it. But, you know, some things would immediately, like, move me. And that's also the way it was with in Sonic Youth. Like, I could definitely do something, you know. Like, Massage the History, I knew I could do something with that. It's funny. It just occurred to me the other day that it's kind of not dissimilar in that way. Mm-hmm. And then we did do some things that were, like, you know, Cool Thing or Nature Scene that were kind of had moments of were reference to hip-hop or...
Yeah, I was surprised to see, I don't remember where it was from, but I read an interview with you where you were saying for Cool Thing that LL Cool J's Going Back to Cali was one of your favorite music videos of all time. I thought that was super cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely an inspiration. And the song kind of came about, you know, I was supposed to review LL Cool J's new record, and I interviewed him, and I was always curious how working with Rick Rubin was and what his knowledge of rock was, or, you know, or was about Rick, you know, who brought what. And because I really liked Radio, I really liked that record a lot. And I was disappointed to learn that he was really into Bon Jovi.
Really?
And in a way it makes sense, like, but again, like, I think it's because Rick probably, you know, like the big chunky power chords of Bon Jovi that was kind of, you know, like that went with the space and the beats he was doing and in some of the music. And anyway, so that's where it was part of the inspiration for the lyrics, you know, like being disappointed in somebody. But you're not into dissonant guitars. And I always thought, actually, hip hop would be so much, it'd be cooler if they kind of were into more dissonant, kind of like their idea of rock is kind of corny in some respects. So anyway, so I think Justin's someone who appreciates that. I never said that to him, but, you know, he appreciates that this is going to make a trap speak sound different, you know, like.
It reminds me of, have you heard Yeezus? Kanye's Yeezus?
Uh-uh.
I wonder if Justin's a fan of that album. But it's very, like, it feels like industrial music inspired.
Yeah. I heard him do it live in a horrible, at the Met, at this, the Met Ball, and it was, the acoustics were terrible. I thought it was terrible. But I didn't, honestly, didn't sit down and listen to it, the whole thing. But I'm sure he was a fan of it. I'm sure he was.
Yeah.
He calls me Kimye sometimes. So bad.
And now that you're in the full interview cycle promoting the new album, how do you feel about doing interviews? I know that's like a strange thing to ask you in an interview, but...
Oh, that's a good question.
You've been interviewed so many times for so many years. Like,
yeah. I mean, I think I've done over 50 interviews for this record so far.
Wow.
And then I did a couple of interviews yesterday, and one was with someone, I think, in Poland. And he's quoting my interviews I've already done for this record.
Really?
And actually, it was fine because I could clarify a couple of things that were, you know, taken out of context or whatever. But at the same time, I thought it was kind of strange. Because I think I started doing interviews last fall when I was in Europe. But, you know, it's a necessary evil. Sometimes I like it, you know, like... It depends on the interviewer, really. And it's made me think so much about the record, and I don't like that. Like, I can give explanations for most of the songs, but I don't feel like it's always a good idea. I think it's nice when people come to their own conclusions sometimes, or like project what they want. But for some things like the song I'm a Man, it's kind of useful to explain it.
Does it seem like people are missing the mark with the questions they're asking you about the album?
Sometimes. I mean, the worst question I've been asked is, why did you make another record? And like, I think they want me to say, because of the pandemic or something. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't have a good answer. I was just like, I don't know. I was bored. I didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a difficult question to answer.
It seems miraculous. Like for some, I don't make music, and it seems like to create something out of nothing just seems incredible.
Yeah, but it is like, you make something in a space that wasn't there before. And that's, it's like you made a room or something, you know.
We're going to take a quick break and then come back with more from Kim Gordon and Leah Rose. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. Here's Kim Gordon with Leah Rose.
So back to the dissonance. Somewhere I heard you say that you felt like extreme noise and dissonance can be really cleansing.
Yeah.
Do you remember when that first struck you?
Well, probably driving around in Western Mass in this, in my car, and this everything covered in snow, and just kind of, it's not sentimental, it's not emotional, it's not, I don't know. And it's just like looking at suburbia, it's just kind of like, I just want something to cut through this. This is kind of depressing, I just like the idea that I could be driving around this super banal, some of it beautiful landscape, but then some of the suburban parts, depressing, and how kind of funny, about music that you can just have it in your head and be, it can contrast so much with what's going on around you, and it creates its own, it sounds stupid, but it creates its own architecture, environment, space, and transports you. So
you said that before you started making the album, you wanted to do something that was more beat driven. Do you remember why you wanted to do that?
Because I feel like, I'm inspired by rhythm. I really like. And when I first started playing with these two girls, when I first started playing guitar back in 1980 or something, it was for this artist, Dan Graham's art performance. It's called Mirror Performance Audience, where he'd have a mirror standing behind a huge mirror, like a giant wall-sized mirror. And he would just stand there and describe the audience, their gestures, their shifting in their seats. And then he would turn around and describe himself in the mirror, having the audience. It was all very self-conscious. And he wanted to do the piece with an all-girl band because he was writing articles about the Slits and feminism in rock and all this stuff. So he introduced me to this girl, Miranda, Santa Miranda, and we started playing, and then this other musician, Christine Hahn, joined us. But at first, my idea was like a drum machine with, someone taught me how to play like half jazz chords, just like fretting the bottom three strings. So kind of doing that, and then getting lyrics from like women's magazines, ads for different colored lipstick, and I don't know. Mm-hmm. There was like a talking song that we did that was taken from kind of this first-person text on the back of Cosmopolitan. It's like, I'm a cosmopolitan girl, and describing the whole thing. Anyway, so that was a song. So I kind of like, from the very beginning, I sort of did that in a way.
Was that around the same time you were writing for, you started writing for magazines in New York?
Yeah.
So you were writing about male bonding and what happens between men on stage in bands. Was that the actual impetus of you joining what became Sonic Youth?
Well, yeah, Dan was writing these articles about women in rock. And so to be sort of rebellious, I thought, I'm going to write about men in rock. But there was this composer, Rhys Chatham, who was influenced by, but Lamont Young, he studied with Lamont Young. But he applied it to electric guitar. So he and he told Glenn Branca, and so they were both doing kind of writing pieces of music with open E tuning. So Reese had this piece called Guitar Trio. It was, so what they would do is they would take a hit of anal nitrate, this stuff called Locker Room. It was a popular drug in the West Village among sort of the gay community. They would take a hit of that and then downstroke on the guitars and in this rhythm. Anyway, so the first thing I wrote was just a description of that performance. It was very short. It was called Trash Drugs and Male Bonding. It was for this art magazine called Real Life. Yeah, and then I wrote longer pieces that involved a group of male artists, whatever. But in order to do my research, I read books by John Ritchie because I couldn't really find any material that described, that talked about male sexuality in a certain way.
Hmm.
So these John Ritchie books were kind of about the gay bar scene in the West Village and kind of this idea of needing distance for desire. But I did feel like, well, maybe I'll learn more about male bonding if I'm in a band or something. But I met Thurston through Miranda and we started playing music together. Yeah.
Do you think the desire to go that far with learning what it would actually be like by embedding yourself in a real band of boys, mm-hmm. do you think that has anything to do with your dad being a sociologist?
Well, I thought maybe so in retrospect, because he did have this book on his bookshelf called Men at Work. And I used to look at it and wonder, what's that about? And why isn't there one that says women in work or something? But yeah, I don't know. I guess, you know, in a way that a lot of lyrics on the record are kind of stem from a sort of sociological kind of observation, you know, interest. And some of it is emotionally reactive.
Did you actually ever learn, like, did you ever get the knowledge that you were seeking in the beginning? Like what happens between men on stage in bands? Did you have any big takeaways from being in the band for so long?
Not really, actually. I mean, no, nothing that surprised me. But there's a difference between playing bass and electric guitar, I think. And maybe it has to do with the sound you get from electric guitar, but it definitely feels like this more of a sense of power. And, you know, just electricity is kind of an interesting thing to use that way, and you can subvert it with your body and moves with your body. And some of those heroic gestures, windmills and things like that, it becomes staples of, you know, arena rock or just like any kind of rock, or like they do something to the sound in a way, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it also is kind of has to do with people playing in bigger and bigger places and then make so the gestures become bigger, more performative or something.
But now it sounds like you play with mostly women?
Yeah, it just kind of happened that way. The first incarnation of the band there was a male drummer, this guy Sterling Laws, who's great. And then after the pandemic, you know, people had other commitments. And, mm-hmm. But it's great. Like, I have so much fun playing with them.
It sounds like you became more aware of being a girl in the band after Sonic Youth was signed to Geffen.
Mm-hmm.
In your book, you talked about how you would intentionally center yourself on stage.
I don't really intentionally center myself on stage. That's just the way Thurston wanted it.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, that has nothing to do with, I think it has to do with separating the two guitars, you know, and having the bass in the middle next to the drums. It's really what when I think in my book, I was describing being in the center of the stage or something. Believe me, it's not what I would have first chose. Actually, when we first started going to England, you know, in 84, maybe, that's when people started asking, what's it like being a girl in a band? And why don't you have like a persona? Mm. You know, like, why aren't you all dressed up like Susie Sue or Lydia Lunch or something? that's when I first started becoming more self-conscious about it, I guess.
Yeah.
But then when we signed to Geffen, I realized, oh, I have this platform now that's a little bigger. It's not like we were really in the mainstream. And so I thought, oh, I have other lots of topics I can write about as a woman or a girl. And yeah, like, so that's our favorite swimsuit issue. Because also right after we signed to Geffen, there was this big Me Too moment that happened between this big A&R guy and his secretary. This was in 90 or 91 or something.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And then shortly after, I guess a year or so after you were signed, you went on tour opening for Neil Young. What did that change for Sonic Youth ultimately?
I guess it made our name a little bit more known. Again, you know, people kept asking us what it's like to be in the mainstream, and we really weren't. And it was quite apparent from Neil's audience that we weren't. But I think it did do something. And we learned how to play on big stages. But when we toured with them, we didn't even have guitar techs. Like, we actually had hired these two friends of ours who played in a band who'd never guitar teched. And we never really got sound checks in the beginning either. So for a while, like, every guitar Thurston would pick up would be out of tune. And then he would be frustrated and smash it a lot of times. And then Neil's guitar tech, Larry, who was awesome, would like fix it. But it was a tough tour, actually.
Was that the first time you played really big stadiums? And
yeah, and the only show that wasn't seated was, I think, the Cow Palace. And that was great because our fans could come forward. But otherwise it'd be, you know, empty seats or like a hippie giving you the finger or something.
After this quick break, we'll be back with the rest of Kim Gordon and Leah Rose. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. We're back with the rest of Leah Rose's conversation with Kim Gordon.
How do you think growing up in LA in the 60s, how do you think that shaped your point of view as an artist?
Well, it's more like the school I went to did a lot to shape me. It was the lab school at UCLA, and it really was a lab school. Like, it was a lot of learn by doing. There was like an incredible grounds, you know, like Neutra building design and a huge grass area, a huge cement concrete area with a gully that ran through the school up into these kind of maze of and pathways of brushes and bramble. And then there's like a adobe house and a stagecoach and an African hut. So when we were studying early California, we would make dye fabric and make shawls and make fringe and grind corn and skin a cowhide, you know, and go to Dana Point and throw it off like the early settlers. Wow. And stuff like that. And there was like a, you know, art program and a music appreciation program and a eurythmics class. I loved it. Like, it was great. It didn't prepare me for regular school, but yeah.
What was it like skinning a cow when you were, were you like?
Well, we skinned the cow hide. They gave us this hide that we stretched out in the sun. And then I didn't participate in that so much.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah, it was kind of gross. But it was fun going to Dana Point and pretending. There's a lot of pretend stuff.
And you wrote in your book that you've always known, even as young as the age of 5, that you were an artist.
Well, I wanted to be an artist, yeah. I mean, I wasn't very verbal, but I was good with my hands. And I just didn't feel confident articulating, especially because my older brother, he was very verbal and articulate, but he also was mean. So he would make fun of whatever I said and call me stupid. And I was afraid of making a mistake, you know, so. It was mostly like verbal mistake, you know, like I didn't have a problem with I was making something, you know. So.
Yeah. I was curious, when you became a mom, after hearing about your childhood, you said that you were on your own a lot as a child. Mm-hmm. When you became a mom, what type of mom were you? Number one, were you like an anxious mom? Were you sort of hands off? Mm-hmm. And how is your parenting style different than how you were raised?
I was anxious, for sure. And I read books. You know, if I got stuck with some issue or something, I would read a book.
Yeah.
I know, my mother always said that I was really independent. So that's, you know, why she encouraged that, you know, like. So I did that. You know, I mean, I would let Coco, you know, I would encourage her to play on her own, or, you know. Mm-hmm. But I tried to be more present and interactive with her, you know, as far as telling her how I felt. Yeah, just talking to her more, you know.
Mm-hmm. You talked about, in your book, you talked about when your family moved to Hong Kong when you were a young teenager. Mm-hmm. And the first day you were there, you just were sort of like standing there and said something like, how am I possibly going to survive here?
Yeah.
And I was curious if there's ever been another time in your life where you've had a similar reaction to like, how am I going to get through this?
I mean, that was definitely, it was just such a culture shock, you know. It was first time really being around poverty, and just, it's just so hot and noisy. And yeah, I didn't see anything I recognized. I didn't see any popular culture. You know, it was way before globalization. And I don't know. I guess, you know, when my marriage broke up, that was difficult. You know, like, how am I going to get through this? Yeah, it's just overwhelming.
Yeah.
When I first moved to New York, that was kind of tough, too. Like, not having a lot of money. And I think I got, like, some accident settlement, which helped me have enough money to get an apartment. And but before that, it was every 2 months I was subletting and moving around. And I never had a backup plan. I didn't have Like, I purposely never learned to type.
I love that.
So I didn't want to be a secretary. And I was like, what an idiot I was. Yeah. Somehow I just never really doubted that I would just end up okay.
So you never had a point in life where you're like, okay, I'm ditching this and I'm just going to go like get a 9-to-5.
Yeah, never. I mean, I tried when I lived in LA at one point. I worked as a custom framer. And that was really just hard, having a 9-to-5 job. I got sick a lot.
If you're in a situation like that and you're getting sick a lot, do you look at it like, oh, this is my body telling me I'm doing the wrong thing?
Yeah, definitely.
In your book, you talked about when you were first living in New York City and people, there, maybe it was just one person would call you a hippie and it would just like drive you crazy.
Well, that was my friend, Dan. Oh, no, what he did is he told the landlord, this Belgian man, who he called himself a captive landlord because he couldn't raise the rent. You know, our rent was incredibly cheap. It's like $175 a month or something. But he told him that I was a hippie and that I might have people crashing at my apartment. Oh. Why Dan said that, I don't know.
That's the worst thing to say to a landlord.
Yeah, he would say things, really unfiltered things sometimes.
Did you feel like in those early years when you were in New York that you had to sort of shut off your LA-ness? Did you feel different than the people you were meeting and the scene you were in?
Kind of. I mean, like Reese, this same composer who was actually the music director of The Kitchen at the time. Yeah, I'd have these conversations with him. And he would say, you're always going to be look middle class, you know. Yeah, I definitely didn't feel very New York in the way I dressed or anything.
Did you find yourself changing the way that you looked?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Like, I didn't have contacts and I had glasses. And I got these flip-up sunglasses that I would wear that in an attempt to feel cooler or something, disguise the glasses. But I couldn't afford contacts. It was so poor.
So after you were in New York and you started to become more established and know more people in the art scene, after working at galleries and starting making art yourself, you were meeting a lot of, I guess the art scene in New York City in the 80s, that's when things got really commercial and artists were blowing up. And
yeah, it was beginning. Yeah. Yeah, painting was becoming big.
With all the successful artists that you've known, successful musicians you've known, is there something or a set of things that you can point to that leads to somebody being successful?
I don't know. I can't answer that question. I think that you just, you know, have to really want something. And so you don't really give up, or you're just kind of, you know, follow the thread. If you can find a thread, that's all you need. And then you just follow it.
You described your early days there, or at least yourself, like you were sort of unorganized and you felt like you were a mess.
Yeah.
Do you still feel like that now, or was that just that point in your life?
I think it was more that point in my life. I mean, I'm still not a very organized person, but it doesn't bother me. I mean, I also like have a manager now, so that helps. I don't know, it's just hard when you feel like an outsider to a community, you know? And the art community is probably the roughest. And then I also felt kind of like an outsider to the music scene in a way, because I was a visual artist. And I don't know, like I liked playing music, but I didn't feel like, I guess I felt like middle class, you know, I just felt supremely uncool, I think. You know, like you're around people like wearing all black who look incredibly chic, even though black is a color that doesn't show dirt. And it can be the cheapest clothes in the world, but, you know, at night in a club or, yeah, everyone else seemed much cooler and, you know, and stylized in their look. And I wasn't like that.
At that point, were you looking at people and trying to figure out how you would dress? Like, would you take things from people you would see? Or was that not even something you were interested in?
I just didn't feel like I could do the all black thing at that time. Like, I just felt like, yeah, this is not me, or that's too easy in a way. Or, like, I had, like, well, I bought a pair of these pink, like, patent leather and suede knee boots at 99 Records for $10, you know. And so I would wear those with, you know, whatever pants I was wearing at the time or something. Or, like, it would have one thing that I kind of thought was sort of cool. But I was kind of hopeless at the whole dressing thing.
That sounds bold, though. At least you were taking chances.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I think I was like stabbing in the dark.
Yeah. Outside of music, what else are you working on?
Not too much. I mean, I doing some work in my studio, painting. But I really have been pretty caught up with this and memorizing lyrics. So it's hard to like change heads. So yeah, I have a small book coming out that about my brother. It's more of like an art book that Karma Press is putting out. In March or April, it'll be out. And it's just kind of he died last year, and sort of a celebration.
Oh, I didn't know he died.
Yeah, he was a schizophrenic, and so he never really got to fulfill his potential in any way. And so I often find writing is a good way to make something positive out of something. And just think about, I can't think sometimes unless I'm writing, so.
Yeah. The writing in your memoir, Girl in a Band, was great. I listened to the audiobook version, which I recommend because you can hear you tell your story in your own words.
Oh, thanks.
But the writing was very direct and poetic. I really enjoyed it. And was that hard for you to write?
It was hard to write. And I also was like, well, it wasn't my idea to begin with. I think after the success of Patti Smith's book, people were looking around like, who else would be good? And then when I was trying to write it, I was like, I don't really want to write about myself. So I tried to make it like a portrait of LA in the 60s, 70s, and New York in the 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
And like halfway through, I thought, oh, these should be essays. That would have been a better, more enjoyable form. And I decided the way to write about the band would just be to pick songs that I sang and then write things around them, kind of more in essay form.
Yeah, I thought it was really excellent. Was it hard to get so deeply personal in the book?
Of course, it was. But I felt like, oh, I have to include this. I don't want the whole book to be about this breakup, but it's part of my story. And so it makes sense to put it in. You know, the hardest thing was achieving the right tone for it. And you know, I mean, there's tons of stuff I got to put in. But it's, doesn't serve a purpose. Actually, one of the hardest things about writing it was just figuring out how to explain the art world and write about people because memoirs are such a popular culturist thing that writing about artists, like, is it going to be boring? Or, like, people aren't going to know who anyone is. And then, but then writing about people who are known sounds kind of name droppy, like Sofia Coppola or, Spike Jonze or something like that. But,
Or the Kurt Cobain sections.
Yeah. But I mean, Kurt was more intertwined in things. But anyway, they're just people who I knew at this certain point in their life,
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was hard figuring out how to write about that.
Yeah, I imagine that was a hard press run after that, because then you get questions about all the personal stuff.
Right. I remember being on Terry Gross's show, and she was pushing me to talk more about it. And I kind of said, I think I already said everything I want to say about it in the book.
Yeah.
And she didn't like that at all, because she likes to dig, people to dig. And I don't know, she kind of like closed up after that.
Oh, she got pissed off.
I think she did.
Yeah. I always like to ask people what they're listening to. New music, old music, whatever it is, what you're liking.
Well, Bill Nace has a new record out that I like. It's on Drag City. I just watched this really cool movie, actually, called The Black Power Mixtape.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's based on footage that these Swedish journalists shot from, I think, 61 to 75 or something, or 67 to 75, interviewing a lot of you know, Stokely Carmichael and a lot of the people involved. But also, like, the footage of Harlem at that time was so cool. But this weirdest thing is, like, things don't seem that different in a way. Just, you know, the wealth gap. And, oh, yeah, there's a scene where these Swedish tourists are going through Harlem and the guy's explaining to them in Swedish, like, don't get out here. And just talking about, like, the drug use. And, you know, in the meantime, like, U.S. government is, like, fed drugs into the ghetto and, you know, propagated this incredible, horrible situation. And anyway, but it was fascinating.
Oh, I'll check that out.
It has music, contemporary music in it, and interviews with voiceovers with different musicians. It's really cool.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate you coming on and talking about the new album. And
oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Kim Gordon for talking about her career and her new album, The Collective. You can hear it along with our other favorite Kim Gordon and Sonic Youth songs on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced and edited by Leah Rose, with marketing help from Eric Sandler and Jordan McMillan. Our engineer is Ben Tolliday. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like this show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful finger sticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch, so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.